Well, good day to you. It's Joel with The King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Hey guys, this is John McLaughlin.
This is Dave Barnes.
And welcome to Dadville. Dadville is a podcast where we talk about life, love, and the pursuit of awesome dadding.
On today's episode, we talk with our friend Stephen James. Stephen is a counselor here in Nashville. He runs Sage Hill Counseling, which has now got offices in Memphis. They're slowly expanding and taking over the world because they are really good at what they do. He's really wise.
Really wise.
Really wise.
I'm going to say that I have, at any given time, maybe three pieces of wisdom that my little brain can hold. And I think Stephen knocked one of those out and put one
replaced
one in there.
Yeah. Yeah. John and I both were excited about having Stephen on because he's written books about being a father, about having sons. He knows a lot about this. And so this is one of those episodes we were especially excited about because we get to do some pretty deep spelunking into the world of how dads work and how men work. And Stephen did not leave any crumbs on the table. He pretty much wiped it. I don't know what that means. Can we start that as a euphemism? Dude, he didn't leave any crumbs.
Man, I'll tell you
what,
he didn't leave a single crumb on the table.
Amen to that. I tried to start called Ninjas on the Roof? Did I ever tell you about this? I
vaguely remember
back in
this,
the day.
Yeah. It didn't stick with
it
me.
It didn't stick.
Ahead.
Yeah, but it's basically like impending doom.
Ninjas on the Roof.
Dude, did you hear he and she are starting to date? Ninjas on the Roof.
A couple ninjas on the roof, and they did not leave a single crumb on the table once they got into the house. All right, well, here you go. Enjoy your time here in Dadville.
Dadville. I'm glad we found the time, too.
Oh, I know.
And listen, we really need you to nail this.
Okay, I'll do a great job the first time.
So,
you know, the first TV show I ever did was 700 Club.
Nuh-uh. Uh-huh.
Really?
So they started me out. Well, I did a local one here but went 700 Club. And I'm sitting there, and they intro, and they start. And I just kind of looked at her. I said, hey, can we start over?
No.
And they're like, we record live to tape, so we got to go back and do the whole thing over? I'm like, okay.
Wait, what were you on there doing? What were you talking about?
Pitching Becoming a Dad.
Oh, wow. That is... 700 Club.
Yeah, starting there. Pat Robbins. It wasn't Pat. It was the wife.
The woman. Yeah.
Not the wife, but she's kind of like the wife. I forget her name. She was great. Like, but that was a weird thing.
Yeah.
You know, we have to, everybody
so
stop.
What did you do? Did you actually stop and do,
no, they,
do the whole
they
thing
had to.
Over?
I like, got, the, like, when you look at the host, hey, can we stop? You look at the camera. So I learned very quickly, like,
never mind.
You got to get it right the first time.
Yeah.
Let me tell you,
or not.
We can stop.
Yeah.
Let me tell you a phrase that you can't recover from on TV. Can we stop and start over? Like, you can't just keep rolling. Like, oh no, he said
that wasn't good.
He said the word. He did it. Did he say the?
It was bad. They had me back though, so that must have been.
Oh
well, this is wonderfully. You know, we can edit and move. You start.
This is the opposite of whatever.
You can do whatever you want. Yeah.
Can I say how excited I am to have our guest on today? Because nothing against our previous guests. Love them.
Well, yeah. I have some things against our previous guests. Yeah, since
Steve, and we want to give you space to voice that.
You can air those grievances.
But we've got some legit wisdom and expertise in the room. Stephen James, ladies and gentlemen and dads. Stephen James works with entrepreneurs, professionals, executives and their families and leadership teams to help leaders serve with passion, wisdom, and effectiveness. He's passionate about creating life-changing environments. Stephen is the executive director of Sage Hill Consulting and the creator of the Leadership Lab. That's a lab.
That's great.
That you created.
Yeah, it's a lab. It's experiments.
He's also the
leaders.
Founder and executive director of Sage Hill Counseling, LLC, which is a healthcare startup in Nashville, Tennessee, that develops and manages communities of independent mental health practitioners.
Wow, that sounds so official.
This is
so important.
Mounting.
Yeah, it just gets bigger and better.
Yeah.
I have more.
Wow.
Stephen is the author of 7 books.
I didn't know that. That's amazing.
7.
That's amazing.
Including his newest book, Parenting with Heart, How Imperfect Parents Can Raise Resilient, Loving, and Wise-Hearted Kids. He's been married to his wife, Heather, for 20 years. Over 20 years.
Yeah. Oh, is this an old bio?
Sure.
No, that the word was said over there. I totally missed that.
Over 20 years.
Over 20 years. And you have four children.
Four children.
Yeah. Stephen James, everybody. So, Stephen, I have to. This is where I get to brag on you. So, there's the official spiel. And so, everybody that's listening,
that was just off the top of my head.
Yeah, you were just riffing. That was sort of a Mad Lib. You just got to fill in whatever word you wanted to. So, I get to brag on. I get to brag.
I used to love putting fart and butt in the Mad Libs.
He is the mayor of Fart Butt. So, I get to brag on you a little bit. So, we had seen Annie and I. I'm outing myself, which I know you can't do, but
you're coming out of the closet. Here we go, ladies and gentlemen.
Coming out of the dark. So Annie and I had kind of gotten to a season in our marriage where, like, it was just we had Ben, our oldest, and he was fresh out the kitchen. I mean, like, a month or two old. And
I've never heard that.
Yeah, and and we're just experiencing a lot of new things, a lot of arguments, a lot of, like, we're just not seeing eye to eye. We didn't know how to parent, all these kind of things. And, you know, Annie had been seeing a counselor who was great. I'd been to counseling for a long time with Al, and Al was so wonderful and helpful. But we both kind of felt like we need to, one, go somewhere together, and then we need somebody who can really, like, drill in on this pretty hard.
I do have that reputation.
You do. And so the funny thing is, truthfully, so we kind of, you know, we asked some friends, and I can't remember now who advised us. I know Annie would remember, but I remember somebody said, you need to see Stephen. So I remember going and sitting with you. I remember this so clearly, believe it or not, sitting in the old office buildings with all the noise machines and the sound machine sitting in the hall so nobody could hear the person crying. Yeah, just so loud. But so, you know, we sit down and, you know, you're so kind and welcome. How you doing? And I remember you said, so tell me what's going on, each of you. And I think, you know, I kind of talked for maybe 5 minutes.
Or an hour.
Yeah.
Let's be 5 minutes.
That's evidenced by this intro. Yeah. But so I talked 5 minutes. Annie talked 5 minutes. And I literally remember this so well. You said, okay, so I kind of see what's going on here. And I thought, wait, what? How can you see what's going on? And literally you said, it sounds like this for you, Annie. It sounds like this for you. Is that correct? And we both went, that sounds about right. So and then
thought you were so complex, and you found out you were just
so
ordinary.
I'm so ordinary.
Yeah.
But it began this incredible season of healing for us, and I think you know, Stephen, you've done that in a lot of people's lives for a long time here in Nashville. But I think something I've always been so appreciative for you about. I don't know how that sentence
You
ends.
Can be for me and about me all at the same time.
For you, about you. are a few things. One, your ability to discern is insane. I don't know that I know another person that's as discerning as you are. I mean, that's a real gift. And
Thank
I think
you,
as
Dave.
A counselor and therapist, it's so efficient. It's just speeds that process up because there's not, you know what I mean? I think that's a real gift you have. And that's something I'm so excited to talk about too, Dave. But that, and I think also, how truthful you are. So I think something Annie and I both realized that we needed was not just someone to help us, but someone who could do it in an expedited manner. Yeah. Someone that could really sort of go, here's what I'm seeing, and here's what we need to talk about to help with this, you know. And obviously the faith part of your practice is a massive part of that. And then I think that's what I would say the third thing is, the ability to sort of bring it into a biblical, Christ-centric context and go, how does the Lord think about this? How do we think about the Lord with this, et cetera?
I don't think I ever said that in a counseling session with you.
Well, no, you didn't. But I think the way you do it is that.
Just, yes.
You know what I mean? You're relating it to our spiritual lives and walks. But so I'm super excited you're here because I feel like, you know, we talked about this before we started recording, but something we really wanted with the podcast is for people to be exposed to not just our friends and not just dads and not just people experienced, but I think people have real expertise.
Yeah.
And so
people who actually know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, I'll go get that guy.
you know him. Can you make that call?
I think I found him somewhere.
Yeah. I also, so that said, I want to read a couple of these book titles just really quickly.
Oh, great.
This is just, and then we can move on. But I just thought this is amazing. So one of the books is called How to Hit a Curveball, Grill the Perfect Steak and Become a Real Man, Learning What Our Fathers Never Taught Us. Another's called This Is Stress.
That sounds great.
Oh my gosh. Flying off the shelves. Another one's called Does This Stress Make Me Look Fat? A Man's Guide to the Loaded Questions Women Ask.
These another bestseller.
These are so, yep, nope, maybe. A Woman's Guide to Getting More Out of the Language of Men.
Uh-huh.
and Wild Things, Yard Nurturing Boys. I mean, that you guys...
You left out one, for sure, that I think is called Becoming a Dad.
Oh, that's right.
So that was the first book.
That was a 700 Club book.
That was that book. It was kind of a memoir around my co-author and I, David Thomas, who's also a counselor. I had kind of my own awakening and kind of spiritual awakening and personal awakening about how my story as a boy and as a man was impacting who I was as a person, kind of in the face of my daughter when she was first born.
Wow.
And so it kind of set me into this quest for more of who I am and more of who God is. And kind of out of that, we wrote this book about the questions a dad is bringing to the table, you know, in becoming a new father, right? And that we talk about there's no weightier title that a man will ever bear than father.
Wow.
Yeah. Like not king, not boss, not, you know, celebrity, but like being a father is all of a sudden this mantle's been placed on me. And all I did was donate a little piece of DNA.
Yeah.
Right. And now all of a sudden I'm ushered into responsibility.
Can you talk about that? Why is that the case?
Yeah, so there's a penis and a vagina.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, no, not that.
Kids, you might want to close your ears. Okay, but sorry. Listen close.
Those are technical terms. This is stuff we really need help with. So the main reason why we brought you in here.
So not talk about that?
You can. You can.
That would be a different podcast.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Sorry, can we start over?
Dr. Lewis, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Talk about what?
The father. Why father is such a bigger deal than king or
oh, man.
Boss.
Because I think all of us have had fathers, whether we knew them or didn't know them, right? Yeah. There's this, we know we've come from somewhere that's not us, right? And that's true biologically, but it's also true emotionally and spiritually, is that we come from a place that's even beyond ourselves, you know? And we didn't have a choice to be born. We didn't have a choice to come into life. We didn't get to choose who our father was. And for me, I pretty quickly knew when our daughter was born 18 years ago now, almost 19, whatever I thought being a father was, like, I didn't feel up to the task.
Wow.
But I just had this innate sense one day of getting her out of the bath. She was, you know, probably 16 months old or so, and we got her out of the bath, and she looked at me in the eyes, like, really, like, looked at me. Like, she wasn't ashamed to look at me. She wanted to connect with me. And it kind of exposed this thing in me that I was afraid to look at me. I didn't want her to see me. And I turned my gaze from her, right?
Wow.
And it's a very existential moment for me where I looked away from her because I didn't want to be seen. And that took me into a place of kind of ambivalence of like, I want to be a great dad, but to be a great dad, I've got to actually be a better version of me and address some things and secrets and ideas and wounds that I didn't ever want to face, right? And so I had this choice of like, was I going to give my daughter what she needed or was I going to stay protected? And that was a real, even more than getting married, like having a child kind of moved me into a place of powerlessness and awe and gratitude that was so weighty, right? And that I knew it was something I couldn't live up to.
Wow.
You know, and now I know I can't live up to it. Which is some freedom on the backside of that. I think I spent the first, 14 years of, you know, I have four kids. And so oldest is 18, the youngest two are 13. So we've got four teenagers, right? So with the first 14 years trying to live up to an idea of being a dad. And as a best-selling parenting author, I had all the tools.
Proceed.
All right, you know. Let me tell you how to do that. Hold on, let me read my book.
Let me put an effect on your voice right now. Hang on.
And I think over the last several years, as my children have moved towards adulthood, and I've realized a lot of what I've been able to give them has been great, and a lot of what I've been able to give them has been very limiting, and that they really are with me for a time.
Yeah.
You know, I'll always be their father, but they really are made to live their own lives, not live with me. And that's kind of does a wow, I can't go back to when they're seven and fix that thing. And if I try to fix that thing so that I feel better, I'm really putting something else on them, right? Right, you know? Yeah. Let me make up to you. Let me make up to what a bad dad I was.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Right.
It's like, okay, dad, like I thought we were past that. Or, you know? So, but this idea now, I'm walking in this idea of being a father is more about being with my children wherever they are in their development, and less about stamping out, you know, a child in the image that I want to make them, or the image I think that they need to be, or you know. And it's been a real undoing of me in a lot of ways. My ideas of parenting, my ideas of identity, my ideas of my own father, who Heather and I are as a couple, right? Like, kind of let go of the idea that parenting is an outcome-based thing, which really, this is interesting. And you can read about this in Parenting with Heart. The word parenting did not come into the English lexicon until the 1950s and 60s.
Really?
And
really?
We can mostly thank James Dobson for that.
So no way.
Yeah. It's a brand new idea of parenting, of the way you interact with a child as an adult will get you some outcome with the child, right? And it's not bad. So all the users who are black and white thinkers and dualistic in your thinking, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying that it's a brand new idea. And as we got into psychology, which is a new thing, right? Yeah. It's this study of human behavior is new in the 20th century. We started applying it to children in the mid-20th century, and that became a psychological approach to parenting, that if I do this, my kid will do this, right? Which ends up being a very narcissistic approach.
Right.
Subtly, yeah. Very subtly. It makes kids products, not people. It makes their behavior more of a commentary on us as parents, and we have all this anxiety now as parents about, is my kid going to turn out okay? Which is really a question of, am I going to be okay if my kid doesn't turn out okay?
Absolutely.
You know, so we end up subconsciously putting all that pressure on 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds to make grownups okay. And that's the real plight of parenting. Instead of being a parent, right? There's a real difference between being a parent and doing parenting.
Would you talk about that for a second?
Like I said, for me, like, I'm really trying to walk in this place now of being a parent, right? That I have a role in my children's lives. I have authority in my lives primarily because I gave them DNA and I'm older than them. Like, that's my authority.
Yeah.
You know, you need to respect me because I'm older than you, right?
Right.
And I'm a fool. Respect that, son.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to doing parenting so that my kid will stay in bed at night, or my kid will behave at school, or my kid will act the right way in church, or my kid will do this, right? I learn more about who I am with them and who they are with me by being with them as opposed to doing something on them, you know, managing their behavior or even their character. Trying to create their character is like, instead of living with them in a way of trying to discover who God made them to be and kind of seeing more and more of that as they age and seeing them move through these developmental things and having the courage to name what I think is true and have them name what's true about being a child with me, or the best feedback I've ever gotten has been from my kids. Like, they can name the truth about what it's like to be with Stephen James, you know, and it's not always kind. But it's always accurate, you know?
Yeah.
And so just learning that they have more to teach me about living than I do to teach them about living. And what kids need is they need to know that someone's going to be with them through the living. They don't need to know that we have it right. They know we don't have it right. They know we don't have it together. They're okay with us not having it together if we'll be okay with that, right? And they just need to know, are you going to be with me as I grow? Are you going to be with me as I live? Are you going to be with me as I struggle? Are you going to be with me as I celebrate? Are you going to be with me as I die? Right? Like, are you going to stay with me? And the answer to that is no. Like, not all the time. You know, I can't be with you all the time. Like, I'm sometimes doing. I'm sometimes not available. I'm sometimes checked out. I'm sometimes asleep. And there's going to be a time, hopefully, best case scenario, I die before you. And you're going to be alone without me.
Yeah.
And that child's heart never outgrows that, right? So that's even sad. So to be a parent means learning to live with grief, learning to live with celebration, which is the other side of the coin of grief. It's learning to live in the tension of life and struggle and beauty and heartache and repentance and redemption. I mean, all in a meal at Five Points Pizza here in Nashville. I mean, much going on in just dinner time, you know?
Do you feel like there are differences in the mother and father roles, like with the dad and the mom?
Yeah. Heather's a better parent than I am, like in our roles.
Do you feel like
moms in general are better at the being?
No. So this is Dadville, so we're going to tell some Dadville truth.
Yes,
come on. Women suck at relationship just as much as men do. Hmm. They're just as bad at human relationships. They don't tell the truth as well or in different ways. Women, female relationships for women are really, really hard and really, really nuanced and complexed.
Or complexed. One.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that you outed yourself on that. Women have complex talk. Lots have funnies.
You know, and men struggle in relationship in different ways, right? And so we all struggle in relationship. We all struggle in being ourselves with each other and with ourselves and with God. Like that is our struggle, yeah, is being. I do think that mothers get a head start on being with their children because we know through science that they're actually bonding while the child is in utero. And so let's talk about adoption in a second, but a mother that grows a child inside of her is actually doing neurochemical bonding with the child as well as emotional and spiritual bonding with the child. Mm-hmm. Whereas the dad, you know, I've talked to so many dads that are like, look at their wives, like, you know, 6 months pregnant and go, you're pregnant. And she's like, that's what I've been telling you for 6 months.
Yeah.
He's like, I know, but you're really pregnant. And she's like, okay.
Yeah.
And so there's a sense of which a mother has a little bit of a head start. And if a mom breastfeeds, there's a real attachment bonding that's going on there that, like, it's fascinating. A baby, when it's born, can only see 18 inches. It can't see further. It can't see closer. Can't focus its eyes.
Oh, I didn't know it could see closer.
Yeah, I didn't know it could see
closer. No, it can. It's got only a fixed depth of view. So it might have it's probably a few inches either side of 18 inches, right? But it can see the distance from breast to face.
Golly,
that's amazing.
And a human child is neurologically wired to recognize the human face. Girl children, girl babies, will respond to the human face more readily than boy babies. Boy babies will respond to inanimate objects, things with hard angles, more than girl babies. So there is a fundamental difference in the brain wiring of a typical male brain and a typical female brain. And then there's everything in between.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's not a male brain and female brain. There is a male brain and a female brain. Right. And then there's all this space in between.
Yeah.
So there's a way in which women, we're going on a deep end of this neuroscience.
Come on.
So the female brain women have smaller brains than men, which actually allows them to have more goo around their brains, which allows their brain to connect with itself and connect the dots in a quicker and more efficient way.
Wow.
So the metaphorical way to think about it is women's brains function more in webs and connections, and men's brains think more linearly. It takes us more energy to connect dots because we have less goo. So to say women are more relational is a misnomer. Women think more in relational web-like interactions and can see how all the dominoes fall more naturally than the male brain. Okay. And so I just think that's really interesting. Like, and how we have implications from a neuroscience or brain structure standpoint and how we move in the world through our gender, right? Especially in the category of parenting.
Yeah.
You know? And kind of the joke or the metaphor I use is a typical mom will know if lunch isn't made properly on Monday, what's going to happen to the kid on Thursday?
Yeah.
Where dad's like, we can just give him some lunch money.
Yeah.
It's like, you can't give him lunch money because we have gymnastics and we have this going on. Right. And the dad's like, okay. A dad can underemphasize things. A mom can overemphasize things. It might be easier to say a mother can tend to overfunction in a relationship with her children. A dad can tend to underfunction. And I've seen a lot of the opposite, where a mom can underfunction and a dad can overfunction.
Yeah.
Right. So that's something. I don't know how we got on all that. That's just a lot.
Man.
So I do think that men and women are different biologically. I don't think men and women are different emotionally and spiritually. I think we're all made for relationship. We're all made in the image of God. And we find our meaning and purpose in relationship with ourselves, others, and God. And,
yeah.
But how that's embodied or incarnated in the male body and the female body, we move into the world differently. Right. And I think moms get a head start. Now let's talk about adoptive parents. There's a really cool thing going on in the adoptive world the last 5 to 10 years is we're telling the truth about parents who adopt are doing a really great thing. And it's not the ideal. That the ideal for the child is to be raised by the biological parent And when a child can't be in a healthy way, adoption is the very next best choice. But what we're finding out through, like we've always known, but we're being able to have the courage to tell the truth about through a lot of science and attachment theory stuff, is that that bonding that takes place between a mother and child and a father and child is so fundamental that a kid who is adopted is always going to feel a little disconnected from mom and dad. And the mom and dad that can accept that and begin to talk and wow. engage mm-hmm. a child around that gives the child permission to attach the mom and the dad.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeez.
Right? And the mom and the dad that can't end up giving the kid more anxiety and more shame, because the child intuitively and subconsciously knows my parents feel ashamed of me being adopted, or they feel scared of me being adopted, or yeah. they feel lonely with me being adopted, and I'm going to have to keep that in because they can't handle it. Right?
Yeah.
I have friends that adopted a long time ago, and I've got friends and family members that adopted recently. And the whole conversation around adoption and giving permission for parents and children in adoptive families to tolerate that disconnect is yeah. awesome.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's like it allows them to actually be in relationship around what is, instead of this mythical, ideal fantasy world of, you know, what's impossible to
me. I would think that's going to come hardwired, especially when you have international and different cultural adoptions where you're having, like so many of our friends have.
I'm thinking of a couple that adopted a little girl. They live in Nashville. They adopted a little girl from Memphis. Same race, a little bit different social class, but a totally different gene pool. And yeah. by that, I mean, you know, all human genes are 99.9% exactly the same. So 0.1% makes all the difference genetically for us with race, gender, height, weight, you know, all that stuff. The daughter in this family articulates a lot of life like her biological mother. And she has two very driven, successful, smart, accomplished parents, right? And the daughter's like, let's take a nap today. Oh, isn't that a pretty tree? Like the daughter's an artist. Like the way uh-huh. she engages the world is much more like artistic and dramatic. Yeah. And like, I want to be in the spotlight. And the parents are like, that goes against our values, right? And so this child is bringing something into that family that yeah. is of DNA and yeah. is of emotional and spiritual heritage that I think is actually really redemptive for this couple. Right? Because it's causing them to kind of see life in a bigger, different way that is causing them to learn and grow as,
yeah.
you know, people in their 30s, 40s, than if they created another little mini-me, it's like that challenges them in a different way.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not just international.
Yeah.
That's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
Though my sister adopted from Ethiopia.
Oh, wow.
Right? And someone in the grocery store said, are you going to tell her she's adopted? And my sister said, we haven't decided yet.
Oh, my gosh.
the insanity of my daughter's holding this beautiful black-skinned girl, right? And my sister, wow, that was a Freudian slip.
I was going to say.
kind of raised her a little bit. my sister's holding this beautiful black-skinned girl. This woman's asking, are you going to tell her? Like, that speaks to the denial that we have about heartache and pain and struggle.
Yeah.
And, you know, and my sister has said, like, when they brought, you know, their daughter home, the child that had the most disruption was actually their biological son.
Mm, yeah.
Because he had just been displaced, right? And he had this 2 or 3 year kind of attachment struggle, right, is what we would call it now, just because they did a good thing and literally saved the life of a child that was left on a doorstep of an orphanage, you know? But it was their son that was like, that felt missed in it, right?
Yeah.
So,
So speaking of your new book.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Parenting with Heart.
So there was one thing as I was reading through that caught my eye for a very obvious reason. You talk about how good enough is perhaps the let me get this quote exactly right here, because this gives me so much hope. Good enough might be the most excellent way to parent. What do you mean by that?
So we're borrowing a phrase from kind of the first child psychologist named Winnicott. Okay, so he was in England, and he started thinking about this idea of how parents and children interact. He's kind of the first thinker. It's a contemporary of Freud. and he made a list of 14 reasons why every mother hates their child. And he published it, and mothers went crazy.
Yeah.
Right?
Except for that one mom was like, oh, my gosh.
That's the truth. I feel so known.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And it was things like, they will leave you.
Yeah.
They take energy from you. They won't stop crying when you want them to stop crying.
Yeah.
You know? And what Winnicott was getting to is that there's human condition in us. There's this part that, like, we're selfish, and we don't ever outgrow being selfish. And if we can let ourselves be good enough, which means be present to, bring ourselves to, like, do I really believe that I, as God made me and who I am enough for this child? Or do I believe I have to become something more, right?
Yeah.
And I have learned for me that when I'm myself with my kids, that's actually what they're looking for. Like,
yeah.
They're looking for, like, am I enough? That doesn't mean I'm everything they need.
Right.
And that's a really hard idea for parents to come to, is that my kids need more than me.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, even from birth, like, they need more than me. They need to sleep, right?
Yeah.
It's like, wow, they need most of their time of an infant is actually not being with their parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, which I think that's just paradoxically this weird thing, right? You know, the original title of the book that the publisher hated was called Giraffes on Ice.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
Everybody loves that. Except the publisher.
Yeah,
and right. Y'all know that when you sign over rights to something, you sign over the rights to something,
right? Yeah.
So
that's how that works.
So we negotiated a different title. But the idea of the original book was, like, we are all giraffes running on ice. Yeah. So you get that picture of the best we get as parents is this gangly desert creature with a scarf kind of slipping and sliding on a frozen pond.
Yeah.
And that's what parenting is. And if
it's so fascinating, because it seems like, as I was reading your book, it seemed like you were almost saying, like, look, guys, before you read through this book, you need, however long this takes, you need to really come to grips with the fact that you are not great at this.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you are the perfect person to parent your child.
Yeah, I don't need to be a great parent. I need to be great at being Stephen.
Right.
Right.
Which is so,
good night.
So hard.
Oh.
To do that.
So hard. Yeah.
Which
was impossible.
I mean, what's fascinating about what you said a little bit earlier, how parenting was not even in our language 75 years ago or whatever. So this is just new. This is a modern guilt that we have upon ourselves.
Yes. It's part of the, I think it's a deep philosophy about how industrialization has robbed the human spirit of our agrarian nature. We can go off into that. I don't want to do that.
No, but that's a good point.
Right, but we've industrialized child rearing, and even our education system is more modeled on factory production than it is actually how you educate children, right? And the book Wild Things, The Art of Nurturing Boys, put out a lot of research that talks about putting a boy in a classroom and asking him to sit still is asking him to go against everything inside of him.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then when the teacher says, because you talked, you can't go to recess, like, she has just slit her throat metaphorically in the classroom the rest of the day and basically told this boy, look, I'm scared of your masculinity, so I'm gonna cut it off so that I have some more control. Like, so even education, industrialization of the human heart, man, it is bad for children. But that's what parenting has kind of turned into, is these parenting workshops, most of the parenting books have a lot of great information, are subtly, though, teaching parents how to behave to get the outcome you want for your child. And that is a part of being a nurturer and a provider and a leader for children. But it's certainly a small part, because if a child is attached to who the parent really is, which means the parent needs to be attached to who the parent really is first.
Yeah. So that's step one, really.
Yeah. You got to be with you first. You got to know who you are. You have to have done your work to accept who you are. Which is not like that's a one-time thing.
Yeah,
right.
Right. I mean, I'm in a whole new season of kind of doing my work, right, as a man. And there's something, someone said to me last week that I'm on the back nine. And I was like, what do you mean back nine? They're like, well, you're like, you've turned the turn and you're like playing the last nine holes. And maybe several explicatives came out at that point for me. But I went home and I did the math. As of last week, I'm on hole 10.2865.
No.
So I have teed off from the 11th tee box. I am a chip shot from the 11th green.
Yeah.
And it's like that kind of has blown my mind, that like that idea that there's all these things that I said I was going to do that I'm not going to do.
Right.
There's all these ways that I was going to become that I'm not going to become. There's all this weight that I was going to lose that I'm not going to lose. There's all this money I was going to make that I'm probably not going to make. There's all these parenting things I'm going to do that I'm not going to do. There's all these promises I've made to Heather I'm not going to keep. It's like, there's just not enough time left.
Yeah.
And as I live in that, I actually have more of me to give because I'm actually being the man I am as opposed to this ideal that I can't live up to, this aspiration of who I'm supposed to become. And then once I become that, I have something to give people. That is so not the good news, you know?
Yeah.
That who I am is enough, that how God made me is enough, that how I can show up in relationship is enough, right? It's not enough ultimately, but it's enough for now, right?
And, yeah.
You know.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, John.
I have a ton of questions.
Yeah, that's one thing I've always known about you, but let me guess this. Is one of them, what is love, and then followed by, baby, don't hurt me, baby, don't hurt me no more?
No.
Oh.
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
It's more about life insurance coverage and like how much do I need?
Yep.
Which life insurance company is the best and how much should it cost?
Yeah, no,
stuff like that.
Yeah, those are better questions for sure. But guess what?
What?
I have something that can help.
What is it?
Policy Genius.
Oh, Policy Genius. That's that website that compares all the quotes from the top life insurance providers all in one place, right?
Yep, and what's the one thing you hate?
Oh, I hate legwork.
Yep, and it does all of the legwork for you and can save you $1,500 or more a year.
Oh, I hate legwork, and I love $1,500 because that's a lot of mac and cheese and taquitos to bribe my kids with.
Yeah, and you know that pool that you've been wanting to put in?
Oh, yeah.
I want you to put in a pool, too. Well, we could both be $1,500 closer to it. The other great thing about Policy Genius is their team handles all of the red tape for you for free. More for that pool, baby.
Oh, man. And that pool only costs $14.99. So you have sold me, Dave. I know exactly where to start my life insurance search, and I'm going to PolicyGenius.com right now.
Do it, because Policy Genius will find you the best rate and handle the process completely, leaving your family protected and giving you more time to think about that pool that I will come over and use, whether you know it and like it or not. So, really, Policy Genius will improve both of our lives. So don't delay. Try it today.
I need to buy a fence, too.
How much is a fence, you think?
How much is a pool fence combo?
Oh, that's good. John wrote this, and I love this question. It speaks a lot to sort of what you're talking about, and I'd love to hear you talk about this. It says, you say we've seen a cultural shift from parent-centric homes where kids are seen and not heard to child-centric homes.
Yes.
Where parents worried about everything and kids get a trophy for everything. You propose heart-centric parenting where we find space to accept yourself as a parent who may not be perfect but good enough.
This is good stuff. Read more.
Well, this is John.
Thanks, John.
I'm just quoting John here.
And I'm just quoting you.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
So, this is actually comes
this
back
is actually
to you.
Me, yeah.
And you propose that good enough might be the most excellent way. The thing that I'm curious about, because you just spoke to that, is because this is something I struggle a lot with, is sort of paying too much or not paying too much, but thinking about my kids and trying to not coddle them or, you know.
I would ask you, when you say you're thinking about your kids, what are you feeling?
I knew you were going
to Yeah,
do that.
I thought you knew I was going to do that.
Come on. I tried to avoid all of these snares, and I just
Let
jumped
John
into
keep
one.
Talking then.
Yeah,
we
no.
We don't want you to put the spotlight on us.
No,
right
at all.
This is not about our inefficiencies.
No, or just your humanity.
Or our humanity. Yeah.
God,
dog it, I knew you were going to do that. It's so frustrating.
You bring a counselor into the room, you
and
will be
you're
counseled.
You're watching me the whole time. You're just stroking your Gandalf beard. Like, go ahead, silly boy.
Oh, he's going to move right
yeah,
into,
right
this
into the bear trap. Avoid the little one to jump in the big one. Yes, it is so much reflective of my fears and my insecurities and my humanity, your point. But I think, like,
Hold on, because you said but, and but's a negator, which means it erases everything you just said. So let's not erase everything you said.
Right.
Let's put an and there, right?
Yeah.
So you said, when I think about my children, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
When I think about what I need to give them, I'm afraid. When I think about what they need, I'm afraid. Yeah. Just as a thought experiment, what are you afraid of?
There's a lot of things. I think about, am I giving them enough of myself? Am I withholding things so they have access to what they need in me? I think that. Am I paying attention? Am I setting them up to succeed?
Because if they don't succeed, what happens?
We start over. Yeah, and that's contractual. No, I think, it would reflect on me. It would say that I didn't do a good job, that I failed at something I was tasked with. So it's not really about them, obviously, in that it's about me.
So if your children can't tell you how you failed, they're telling you something, right? If you think about your relationships, like our, think of this room, our relationships with our adult parents, to the degree we can't tell them how our experience of them failed us, we know they can't handle us. So if we think about a standard for parenting or a good enough parent, is the kind of parent where a kid can come home after they've been in the world, been in the adult world for a little while and say, hey, I've seen some things and I'm realizing I'm not playing with the full bag of clubs.
Hmm.
Right? There's some things I didn't get in this family growing up. And
yeah,
some of those things you didn't give me or what you gave me is not useful.
Working, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm really pissed and really hurt about it. If a kid can bring that to their parent,
yeah,
and the
like
parent goes,
the good news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then the kid is safe.
Yeah.
And what creates that? How do you create that as a parent?
A parent that's willing to tolerate the truth of themselves.
Great. Yep.
Which means the parent has other adults that tell them the truth.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I feel like you could say that 5 times in a row.
Yeah, I probably will say that. Like you can just echo that one. Echo,
yeah.
Echo, echo.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing is, like, a parent that can tolerate the hatred of their child hating them and them hating their child. Because the contrast of love is hate. Like, we only know love because we got a little bit of hate, right? And so, you know, if you don't know the feeling of wanting to ignore your child to punish them, that passive aggressiveness of, mm-hmm. I'm going to make them pay for what they just did, then how do you know you love your child? And your child's got to be able to hate you. And I'm not saying I hate you, Dad, but be able to like draw contrast with like, I know that you don't always mean good for me. You know, I can tell about how you're interacting with me. This isn't about me. This is about you, Dad. Now, a 4-year-old's not going to say that, but they're sure going to express it.
Yeah.
You know, so if a child cannot cry their guts out in front of the parent, like just grieve to their core, and a child cannot hate their parent openly, right, then the child can't attach to the parent.
Golly, Moses.
Right? Now, that doesn't mean, it means we have to teach our children over time how to be respectful. We need to teach our children, like, hey, there's boundaries. So I'm not talking about a world without boundaries, right? I'm talking about a world where there's emotional permission for the child to have an identity and really discover who they are in the context of themselves and in a family and in a culture. And in a
that
world.
Is so hard.
Oh, it's impossible.
God, yeah. That's hard.
It's not just hard, it's impossible.
As a parent trying to walk that fine line of here is how this child is. So like Xana, my middle, who is so fun.
Yeah.
And she's big and she's bold. But I mean, just the same for the opposite.
Yeah.
When it is wrong, it is. We laughed about this with your girls too. Like how she can go from like, wah, and I can do one thing. She's like, oh my God, that's funny, Dad. I'm like, you are crazy. Something is wrong with you.
Yeah.
But I think like trying to give any sense of rails, some sense, you know, trying to give her a space for that, celebrate who she is and go, thank God. I think we're trying to do that where we don't come in and go, stop crying. We go, okay, hey, can you just like, let's pull that in, you know, and not go, don't cry or don't act crazy. But that's so hard. It's hard to know how to navigate and give your children, like you said, some sense of boundaries while not squashing who they are.
Yeah. We read a series of books called Alcatraz and the Evil Librarians, which is some kids' books, actually.
Oh, wow.
Right? And it was eye-opening for me. And it was about this kid named Alcatraz Smedri. I'm going to go on a long tangent. Alcatraz is adopted. He's in foster care. And everything he touches, he breaks. So he gets moved from foster home to foster home to foster home. And his last foster home he's in, he burns it down trying to make breakfast for himself. And one day, this old man shows up and says, I'm your grandfather. I'm here to rescue you. You have to come quick. The librarians are after us. And the kid's like, what? A grandfather? What? And he goes, yes, you're a Smedri, my boy. Come on. And he kind of talks this kid, it's a kind of weird old man, talks this kid to jump into a car and driving off with him to kind of save his life. And what the kid finds out over the course of the first few chapters of the novel is that he lives in this alter world called the Hushlands, which is controlled by the evil librarians that are suppressing the truth, and that he's actually from the clan of Smedri, who has magical powers. His power is the breaking power, which is the most powerful thing of all. And that, think about that. So when someone points a gun at him, he can point at the gun and the gun breaks.
Wow.
His grandfather's power was showing up late to everything. He's been late for his death on several occasions.
Oh, right? That is genius.
He's got a cousin. When she goes to sleep, she wakes up with like really bad bedhead, but she can disguise herself and look like somebody else, right? He's got another cousin that gets lost. And so if they're being chased, he leads the way and they'll end up like in Tibet. You know?
That's
right?
Amazing.
And so this author starts turning this thing around on us in this book, where we start thinking our greatest foible is actually our greatest strength.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we start thinking about our kids that way, and we start naming their personality in a different way.
Yeah.
We start seeing, wow, because it's true for us. Our greatest strength is our greatest limitation, and our greatest limitation is our greatest strength, right? And so we start seeing that for our kids. You think of your daughter, and you go, wow, she's a wild card, right? And she's not going to be managed.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's like, I wouldn't be too worried about her going on her first date then, because
yeah,
she's going to tell the guy exactly the way it's going to go.
Right? Well, and that's exactly what I have two girls.
Yeah.
And on my way over here, my wife was like, she stopped me and she was like, will you, in all seriousness, will you ask him how we raise these two girls who have complete control over us? I mean, my daughters, Luca and Livy, they are...
It's like a band right there.
Whatever is in there is so great. Yeah. If I could be... Honestly, if I could just put it on pause for like, you know, another 10 years or something and make my life a little easier.
We never get better than 4 years old. That is the best we get as human beings, is 4 years old.
Yeah.
We're so pure-hearted. We're so open. We're so ourselves. And then everything after that's just skills.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Uh-huh.
Like, but our humanity is... And even Jesus said this, like, unless you come to me like one of these children...
Right.
Right. This is as good as it gets.
Well, and I was thinking about that when you were talking about when your daughter was 16 months old and you had that moment in the bath. I mean, how amazing is that?
Oh,
she didn't say a word, just looked at you.
Yeah.
Probably have had so many friends and colleagues around you who couldn't get through in the way that she got through to you in that look, you know?
Yeah.
But I wholeheartedly agree. Like, my daughters are not going to be, they're not going to have a problem on that first date.
Yeah.
That's great. What about me in the next?
You're going to have a lot of problems on the first day.
I have to be with them every day. You talk about how like your children will become, they will become at 50. It's shaped more by their experiences, more so than how we teach them how to behave.
Yeah.
Which I feel like, you know, that says I'm like looking at this from the wrong angle. Because every day, whether I'm, you know, giving myself a pep talk to come in, how am I going to handle how they're going to behave in the morning. They're not going to want to wear that outfit. They're not going to, whatever it is, how I can wrangle these kids in. Or fast forward 12 hours when I'm laying in bed at night and I'm like, I didn't do that right. I didn't teach them right, or I didn't say the right thing or whatever. Can you explain that a little bit more? What do you mean by they're shaped more by their life experiences more so than how we're teaching them how to behave?
Yeah. What I mean by that is we're shaped more by our life experiences than by how we teach them to behave. Children are...
That was Stephen James,
everyone.
Right? Thank you so much.
Children are terrible at following directions, right?
Yeah.
Adults are bad at following directions.
Yeah.
You know? And we've...
That's why I want to teach my kids how to
follow directions. I would much rather my children
to
learn to follow their own internal locus of controls, the big fancy word, but it's like listen to their own self, learn how to know what's good for them or bad for them, as opposed to follow some outward set of rules that let them down. Life is going to break their heart. There's nothing we can do as parents to stop that. We can be with them in the heartbreak. You know, we can help them we can be agents of healing for them. We can help mend it. We can not fix it. It will not prevent it. There's nothing we can do to prevent our child's broken heart. And if we do, we've robbed them of the experience of being human. Right. And if we can really see as a parent that as my child moves through life, their heart is going to be broken over and over again, usually in the same way. Like if we're really astute parents, we really get to see the way God is marking their story over and over again with the same way.
Because it, right? Which is obviously true for us, fast forward
And so with that, we got to get to go, huh, I wonder what life or God is doing to shape my child and teach my child. And what is my child learning in response to that? Right? How are they deciding who they are? How are they beginning to shape their world? And you can see it, little bitty kids start shaping their world in response to different things. Right? We're very creative. We're very authoritative creatures. We love to play God of our own creation. And that's not a bad thing. That's a thing. That's a human thing. And so your daughters are going to learn more through life about life than they are about you, because you can only tell them about your life. You can't tell them about their life.
Yeah.
You can tell them about what it's like for you to be with them, or what you see in them, or what you see about them, or what you see around them, but only they can tell you about their life. And often as parents, especially in the world today, we want to rob our kids of heartache.
Right.
You know, we want to rob them of the struggle. We want them to feel successful.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest shams we're pulling on our kids is letting them feel successful when they actually haven't done anything.
To the point about trophies.
Yeah. That's you know, so we're seeing kids at Sage Hill Counseling, kids, 20-somethings who are coming out of college, and they're realizing they are so not equipped to be grownups, that they've never struggled. They've never not succeeded. If they have not succeeded, the parents come in and talk to the college administration, right?
Still, yeah.
Like the idea when I was going through college that a parent would call the college, right, is insane. But now it's like they have whole orientations for parents in college.
That's amazing.
They have parent orientation.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Right? And I really think it's coming from this place. Parents are scared to death about life. They don't know how to deal with their own pain. They're afraid of their children's pain.
Yeah.
Right? So if we do better at dealing with our own heartache, struggle, celebration, then we could be with our children in it.
Yeah.
And we're not afraid of their heartbreak. We're not afraid of their skinned knees. We're not afraid of their breakups. We're not afraid of their Fs on their report cards. Right. I'd much rather have my children fail fifth grade than help them pass fifth grade and then get out of college and not know how to go to a job.
Right.
Right. Because we've pushed them through.
Yeah.
You know, I want them to follow their heart and go for it. Knowing we have a chapter in the book called Climb the Mountain of Your Dreams, that a parent's job is to help the child climb the mountain of their dreams, knowing that most people don't make the mountaintop and that it's going to break their heart along the way. And it's going to break our heart for them along the way. That's awesome. You know, and some people do climb the mountaintop, but then guess what happens? You got to come back down. You can't live up there. And that's sad. You know, and
you just can't avoid it.
You cannot avoid it. Life is tragic.
Yeah. Well, and it's good for me to remember that really at best an indirect way, I'm just trying to prevent pain for myself.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like my daughter Luca just started kindergarten.
Oh God. Which is so sad.
So I went to this meeting for dads.
Yeah.
So we had this big meeting, all the dads of the kids in the school got together. We've got a program called Watchdog and all this kind of stuff. It's a great program.
Wow, that's cool.
It's really cool. But so as I'm in this meeting, we're supposed to bring our kids with us, and they, you know, they took them out to the little like playground next to the cafeteria there. They've got some teachers watching them, and they're playing.
Y'all drink beer. Someone tapped a keg.
That's exactly right. And so we're sitting there, and I'm looking out the window, and as I'm listening to the speaker, I'm watching my daughter, Luca, and I realize I'm like, as if she's on the soccer field and I'm rooting for her. I'm like, oh, is she playing with that kid? No, she's not. She's okay. She's by herself. Okay. I really want her to find a kid and play.
I really want her.
I really want my daughter to be social. And, you know, I don't feel like I need the trophy necessarily, more as much as it's, I don't want to feel the pain of seeing my daughter in pain. Now, the reality now, at least, is she's fine. She's playing with some leaf or something. She's great.
Doing kids
stuff. This is a great night.
Yeah.
Doing kids.
But to me, I'm like, what does that, does this mean that, you know, come fourth grade, she's not going to be quite socialized? And she's, you know,
which
all
means
that kind
you
of stuff.
Have stories of being heartbroken at some age around not fitting in or not having a friend or getting left behind.
100%.
Or not having a girl couple skate with you at the skate center.
Okay, you're getting two on the head there.
That was one step too far.
That was too far.
So, being conscious of your time, I want to. There's three more questions. We have two that we ask at the end.
Okay.
But I want to ask this one because this is something we've talked about. And I just feel like, especially with Dadville and sort of dads, and this is something you have a lot of things to say on it. So I thought before we ask our two last questions, I really want to hear this to kind of pivot us out of this. But could you talk a little bit as men and dads, sort of the seasons we go through?
Oh, gosh.
You know, just like, can you sort of give the bugle call to like, heads up, dads? You know, here's some things to know this is going to happen. So when and if they do, you don't sort of go like, what's going on?
So the first one, I'm going to make this up on the fly. So
I love this jazz.
The first one is, I'm not ready to be a dad. The second one is, I think it'd be cool to be a dad.
Yeah.
The third one is, oh crap, I'm a dad. Yeah. And then that stays that way a long time.
I was going to say.
If we ever get out of that, it's like, oh man, like it's so cool to be a dad. I'm watching some dads that are older than me telling me about, this is what my children are teaching me as they've come back home. This is what they're teaching me. I think there's this middle area. I don't have much to offer a kid in the early stages as a dad, it feels like. Right. Like I do some operational things like change a diaper, put them to bed, feed them, go to sleep. But I'm kind of like, when do we get to play? Like, and I think a lot of us dads miss that window of going, this is actually the time where just being with somebody is actually really, really cool. They don't really do much. They don't need anything. And so that's kind of the first phase is like, after we go, oh crap, my dad is going, can I tolerate just being with this child and trusting that that's enough? Like, can I let myself be open to the pleasure of just connecting with a little thing that doesn't need anything.
You know?
And then around, you know, two or three, we have this first experience called, I told you so, dad, which is like, no, our child says no. Their favorite word is no. And then mine, right? Which is the beginning of actual identity formation. The child starts to go, hey, I can say no to you. And it drives you crazy. Like, it's time to go to bed. No. And then I get to push this button and you have all this power. So the I told you so dad says, well, you're going to do it because I told you so. So it's about us exerting power, Dave. It's about us exerting power in order to have control.
Yeah.
So we start to get this hint of life being out of control. And then we've got Little League dad. I've coached every soccer level from 4 years old to professional soccer. And so I was really certain my kids were going to play soccer. Sports were a huge thing for me growing up. It was a real salvation place for me where I found identity and community and affirmation and struggle and so much of me. So all my kids started playing soccer at 4, 5, you know, and I was their coach. And by 8, they'd all quit playing soccer. so it's probably the coaching that they had. It's probably it. But it's also that, like, they didn't need it the way I needed it. Right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was fun, but it wasn't, they didn't need it the same way. Right. So it was kind of this Little League dad where I'm like, we're going to go to practice and we're going to get involved. And it was a lot of fun and they had fun around it. And then they kind of moved out of that. Right. And they started moving into their own interest. And then it was about me going, can I be interested in the Rubik's Cube? Cause I've got a son that like does, Rubik's Cube competitions. He can solve a Rubik's Cube in under 20 seconds.
It's insane. Yeah.
Sorry, 20 seconds?
Yeah, under 20 seconds. The world record's like 4 seconds. So he's pushing hard to kind of get sub 15 because that makes sure that he gets to these different levels. But I hate the Rubik's Cube. Hate it. It actually makes me nauseous to try to solve Rubik's Cube.
I didn't even know that was possible.
Right.
You could have said like 4 days and I'd be like, man, that's really
amazing.
Quick.
Yeah, no. Jeez. Right. Then there's different kinds of cubes. There's 3x3s, there's 4x4s, there's 2x2s.
My nephew is the exact same.
So I have had to tolerate turning a Rubik's Cube and faking like I'm interested. like, that's what my son's interested in.
Yeah.
Right? Right now, Fortnite's real big. I was raging about, hey, don't play Fortnite. Get off the TV. Why are you playing Fortnite? And my son said, Dad, this is better than you watching soccer because at least we're doing something.
Ooh.
So you getting up early, watch Premier League on Saturday and us having us not bother you because, you know, Chelsea's playing. It's like, we're actually doing something. So
Jeez
I totally
Louise.
Shifted on Fortnite.
If and then you grounded him after he said that.
I did. I said, go to your room. wash your mouth. That was so. Give yourself a wedgie. I said, if you're not number one, then all the time you're spending on Fortnite, if you're not winning, you're wasting your time. So I really want you to play harder. I want you to give more effort to it. It's, I'll go up and cheer them on, and I'll trash talk them while they're playing Fortnite.
Yeah,
like, and, I'll play Fortnite with them, and they love destroying me. Yeah. Right? It's so much fun. They love beating me. So I've gotten into Fortnite. So that's a little bit of like moving out of the script, Little League, or it could be another thing that you thought going to be passionate about, Math League or whatever your thing was, and going, how do I engage my kid in their thing?
Yeah.
Right? And not make their thing my thing, like keep it their thing.
Yeah,
right?
That's a great word.
You know? And then there's, in the background of that, there is what happened to my marriage, right? So your marriage kind of disappears. Like, for a lot of guys, sex life is kind of like on the shelf all of a sudden. And it's like, well, where'd that go? And then we like don't have guy friends anymore because we're working. And so there's all in the background of like the dad stuff, there's all this like man stuff around like, what's my identity as a man? Like, I feel so out of place with these kids. I don't feel like I'm doing a great job. When I try to exert myself, end up raging or pouting, which is what the other things the men do is we pout a lot. We sulk. We feel sorry for ourselves. We start turning to nefarious endeavors to try to medicate that alcohol, pornography, you know, lawns. There's a lot of guys with like obsessive things about lawns. So their lawns are so nice. And so there's this background stuff going on. But if we could join our kid in their thing and let it be their thing and us have our thing along with them, then we get to kind of like learn from them and see and celebrate them and be with them. And then they get to kind of leave us, which is the next phase. Like they leave us. And the real paradox is if we love our child well, they will leave us and give all the love we poured into them to another person. If we don't love them well, they'll spend their life getting over that and they can't love another person. Right. So if we let them leave us, it'll break our heart. But if we do that, there's a pretty good chance they'll come back home.
Man.
And then we want to kick them out again. Right. No, it's like they'll want to come home. Right. Yeah. And so right now, my hope is they'll want to come home for Thanksgiving. And I tell couples when I do like pre-engagement or premarital counseling, if you can't not go home for Christmas your first year of marriage, you're not ready to get married. You're not ready to be an adult and form allegiance with this person if you're so afraid of where you're coming from. You can't go back there and do the rituals of that place the first year, which means most of us weren't ready to get married.
Yeah, right.
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 So it ends with this great homecoming, right? If we have walked through those seasons well, it ends with a great homecoming. If not, our children are always trying to find their identity by pushing against us instead of moving into their own life, you know, and that's sad because they define themselves off of us, not out of God who made God made him to be. So wow. Yeah. Weighty, right, heavy.
So the two, and then we send you off. We ask everybody these at the end.
How did Drew answer these? Because I want to do better than him.
Horrible.
No,
we were laughing. No, they were
we laughed. I know I'm not going to top Al's answer, so I'm just going to.
No.
Yeah.
What is the thing that will make you feel like a successful dad? You personally. Like, what do you want your kids to say at your funeral, for example?
I will miss him. I knew him and I will miss him. And he lived. Like a friend of mine talks about, it's not the dates, it's the dash. Mm-hmm. Right. My friend Chip Dahl, who actually co-wrote the book, Parenting with Heart. He talks about living the dash well. But if my kids can say, I knew him, I will miss him, and he lived. Like that will be, I mean, teary eyed, man.
God, look at me.
Like that's, that would be what I would hope for.
Yeah.
Y'all didn't tell me. Y'all doing Barbara Walters on me.
Which, you know, what I take from that and really what I've taken from a lot of what you've said so far is, and I wrote it on my little sheet here, is just being.
Yeah.
Let's put aside the fact that that's very difficult and perhaps only getting more and more.
Babies
and more
are great difficult. At it.
Babies are great at it. But that's a reflection of like you were with your kids. Like one of the things that I took from Al is how well he knows his kids and how well his kids know him as a human being, which is sort of, in a way, it seems like, yeah, well, of course. But on another hand, I think, well, is that how I approach my relationship with my daughters? Because I can so easily fall into the, like, I'm approaching parenting as a job, you know, like, am I doing this right?
Am I successful?
Well, it seems, the thing that I've thought so much about with my kids is like, that counterintuitive thing for me, which is, who are you? Looking at each kid and going, who are you? What are your interests? and not going, let me tell you who the Barnes are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I think
yeah.
that's the paradigm shift for me mm-hmm. is to go, this is not about you conforming to our family. It's about going, who are you in this family? So when I look at each of our kids going, who are you? How do I celebrate you? How can I be with you in who you are?
How can I tell you the truth about who you are bothers the crap out of
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's such a
and not trying to change that.
Yeah.
Stuff.
It's like, oh, I can see the good side of that. Yeah.
But like, you know, that's weird. It's weird in the way that, you know, one of my greatest fears would be to be somewhere and one of my kids is so who they are that people are like, well, that's kind of.
Oh, we showed up at church one week and two of our kids didn't have shoes.
Oh, my God.
We're walking down, we're Anglicans, so we're walking down the aisle for communion and they're like not wearing shoes.
Yeah.
And the first thought was like, oh, Heather, you're a terrible mother. The second thought was, what's everybody else think?
Yeah.
And the third is like, who the F cares?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, how'd you forget your shoes? He goes, I don't know. I'm a boy. It's warm out. That's a great answer.
Nailed
He's
it.
Like, why are you wearing shoes?
Which is a better question.
It's true.
It's a much better question.
Yeah. Okay, so finally, last question.
I'm scared of this question now because the first one about made me cry.
Well, I did cry.
Oh, good.
What is the one thing you want your kids to know?
A thing I want my kids to know is who they are is enough for them. Like, it's enough. I would hope that they could live in a world where they don't perceive scarcity about themselves, that they're not sufficient,
yeah,
right, but they're enough, and that they can live in need. That they have a belief that their needs are going to be met emotionally and spiritually primarily. So I think I want them to know that they're enough, you know, which means I have to let them be enough. I can't let them fulfill my scripts, you know, there's a lot of them I had, you know. One last story. I do have a nephew that plays soccer. And my kids joke that he's my favorite child. Because when Oliver invites us to a soccer game, I'm like, I will move mountains to go watch
yeah,
the game.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Or a friend of mine's kid, you know, he was playing high school football. I would go watch the high school football games and cheer and was kind of that obnoxious parent, right? Mm. And my kids are like, yeah, you like that kid better than us. And they're able to kind of tell the truth of my story, you know, going, we know you're sad. This is shorthand of saying, Dad, we know you're sad that we didn't live up to your script. And we know you love us for who we are,
yeah.
right? And I do most days. I do love them for who they are most days. And yeah. I love me more and more for who I am most days. You know, and there's lots of days also where I wish I was different than I was. And there's lots of days where I hold a grudge against my children for not fulfilling my fantasies about how they're going to make my life glorious, rich, and full, you know?
Yeah.
But those days are fewer and fewer, you know?
Yeah.
God. Come on, Stephen James.
I mean,
that's good. Dropped it, right?
You did.
Boom.
That's a mic drop. Thank you so much for doing this.
This was fun. Yeah, really I like the Dadville Studios.
All you wonderful, beautiful, kind people, thank you so much for listening to the episode.
If you have a second, please make sure to subscribe, rate, and write a review.
Unless it's bad.
Because that stuff really does matter.
And please follow us on socials. You can find us everywhere at Dadville Podcast.
Also, you can follow us each at Dave Barnes Music and at John McLaughlin to find out more about our music.
Thanks for listening. Dadville.